going to look at the book of Exodus again tonight. And I didn't know if I wanted to call it God Reveals Who He Is or What He Is. I don't like saying what about God. It makes it, you know, that makes Him more of a thing than a person, and I don't know. I don't do good at putting titles on these things. God Reveals Himself is what I have on my notes, so you guys can come up with your own lesson title. Good grief, you guys will probably come up with better lesson titles than me. It could have been called Exodus 34. Actually, the lesson should be titled Exodus 19 through 34, because that's what we're going to do. I thought, why not do the whole book, do half the book in one shot? What I was doing as I was reading through in the next story and the next story, and sometimes when I read the next story, these seven verses, this is a massive sermon right here, and then sometimes I look at I shouldn't slow down too much, and I just see all these different kinds of stories, and what do I want to talk about, or what do I think we all need to think about, and it builds up a lot of steam and movement in these chapters here, and sometimes it's hard to see that because it also comes to a screeching halt when it says, now here's a law, and here's a law, and here's a law, and here's a law. And the story or the progression and the momentum of what's going on in these chapters, you kind of forget about it because you want to look at each law and think about each law. And that's a really good and important study. And we're not going to do that. We're going to skip the laws and try to pick up the storyline. I do think that some of the laws are important. That's not what I want to say. I think that some of the laws are going to be important for the theme of what God is doing here and in the whole story. And I do want to take the time to read a lot of verses. I want to read the Ten Commandments, because even though we know the Ten Commandments, we ought to still reread the Ten Commandments, but also use those as a summary over some of the big chapters where it's just law after law after law, and keep the momentum of the storyline going on. And we're going to end in chapter 34, with what I think are two absolutely important verses here, 6 and 7. So I want to start by looking at these verses and thinking about what God is revealing about Himself, who He is, what He is, what is God like. When I'm doing this with Bible class for kids, I say, when you hear these verses about God, does He sound tall? Does He sound short? Does He sound happy? Does He sound scared? Does He sound sad? What is who He is sound like just from these verses? And I think that that's a really good activity. It fits a lot with what Eddie was saying a little while ago about not just what am I supposed to do, but who is God? And in Exodus 34, 6, that's what these verses are. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression for sin. But he will by no means clear the guilty, visiting iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. This is God. God comes out and says, this is what I am. And he says his name twice. That's part of who and what he is. I don't always know what to do with that. But he says, the Lord, a God, and then he starts giving all these qualities. So these are the sorts of things that I want you to be thinking about. We're going to close with these verses, but you can turn back to chapter 19 if you'd like. What are we willing to learn about God? There's some things about God that people don't want to learn or don't want to accept. God is sometimes a lot more forgiving than people want him to be, and sometimes he's a lot more condemning than people want him to be. And we got to let God be God. And sometimes he has mercy on those with whom he's going to have mercy, and he's going to condemn those on whom he has condemnation. And we don't always agree with that decision. But I think one helpful idea there is to remember that we are not God. We're not God. We are little people. He's the big one. He's the important one. And he comes out and he says things, and are we willing to listen to that? And in the book of Exodus, he is just waving his arms as wide and as large as he can. And he's throwing miracles and plagues down on foreign countries. Well, It's the country. Egypt wasn't necessarily foreign. That's where the Israelites were. He's throwing plagues and miracles down on the people. And he's doing miracles for the people every single day with food that shows up out of nowhere. And he is waving his arms saying, this is who I am. This is my law. These are the things that I like. These are the things that I don't like. I want you to be a certain way. I don't want you to be this kind of... And he's letting us know who he is. And I think it's important to read that idea. And I don't know how we're going to get all this stuff covered because there are just so many neat ideas. So we're just going to start reading in chapter 19. Exodus chapter 19. On the third new moon after the people of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that day they came into the wilderness of Sinai, and they set out from Rephidim and came to the wilderness of Sinai, and they encamped in the wilderness. There Israel encamped before the mountain while Moses went up to God. The Lord called to him out of the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests, and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel. So Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words that the Lord had commanded him. And the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. And Moses reported the words of the people to the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, behold, I am coming to you in a thick cloud that the people may hear when I speak to you, and may also believe you forever. So God shows up, and he comes, and he starts to talk to the people. And God describes what he does with artistic metaphor. I don't think I'd ever paid much attention to that. He didn't say, I saved you from the Egyptians. You know, he's, remember that time when I parted the waters? He doesn't list, he says, I bore you out on eagle's wings. We need to remember that a whole lot of the Bible is poetic. And there are parts of the Bible, like the Song of Solomon, that is so full of poetry that we sometimes go, what are we supposed to do with this? God speaks to us in these sorts of ways, maybe ways that we're less comfortable with. I like the laws. I like the black and white. Sometimes God says, I bore you out on eagle's wings, and you need to think about that idea and what God is for us and how he did this for us, because he wanted to make us a peculiar people unto him. That's the King James in 1 Peter 2. I love that line, but peculiar people, a special people unto him, a treasured possession, something that would be a holy nation unto him, his kingdom of priests. He owns everybody, but he's making these people his people. And what does that mean about God and his interest in people like us and his interest in what he wants us to be like? And the people respond in verse 8, everything that God says, everything, we're going to do it. And they don't even know what the laws are yet. They don't even know. And they were committing themselves to God. Well, don't commit yourself to God until you know anything about God. You don't know what it is. They don't know anything about God. What has God been doing? They don't know all the laws. They don't necessarily know every requirement. They don't know everything you need to do with a lamb and a goat. But they know everything they need to know about God to choose, I'm going to do what God says. That's a really big thing to realize. How much information do you need about God and about Jesus before you realize, I need Jesus in my life? You can make a commitment to God with just a few gospel stories. A lot of people in the New Testament did that. Well, they get all these instructions about how they're supposed to prepare to meet God. They're going to consecrate themselves and wash themselves and keep themselves from different activities so that they will be ready for when God shows up. And there's that statement, God is going to let them hear when he's speaking to Moses so that the people will hear that and they will believe Moses from now on. He wants Moses, he's setting Moses up to be a very special person. Moses is different from so many people in the Bible. And he wants the people to listen to Moses in a specific way. And then he shows up in verse 16. On the morning of the third day, there was thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud in the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast so that all the people in the camp trembled. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended on it in fire. The smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. And we need to let that image sink into our skulls. At the end of Hebrews, the author of Hebrews brings us up, says this is an important thing. Like this scene, this feeling is important for all of us to have in our minds of who and what God is and what he is like, and that he gets louder and louder as he's approaching this mountain. And one of the first things that God says to Moses in verse 21, go down and warn the people lest they break through to the Lord and look and many of them perish. Don't let them break through. Don't let them come up to the mountain. And Moses says, number one, we already made that rule. And number two, do you think they're going to try to do that? They're terrified. And God is still coming down. What does this mean about God? Don't let them break through. He knows they don't want. He knows they're scared. By the end of the commandments that he's going to give in the next chapter, the people are so terrified, they don't want to listen to God anymore because God is too much God for them to deal with. And God knows that. And he's still coming out and saying, guess what? Don't let them break through to touch this mountain. Those are the things that he is thinking about. Even if he knows what we may or may not do in our lives, he's still giving us rules and giving us these boundaries that we need to live inside of. That's a really interesting aspect about God. Even if he knew no one was going to try to break through. And even he calls it breaking through. Isn't that an interesting choice? If you want to do your own will and come up and try to touch this mountain, you are breaking through. God put a boundary for us, and your own thoughts and your own ideas is breaking through that. That's a really distinct, that's what sin is. But this change of vocabulary is a very strong idea that helps us to get a good sense of what is God and what is he like? What is it like when he gives us rules? And this defiance is simply breaking through. And so then we have these commandments. Chapter 20, verse 1. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. That's almost one of the commands, right? I have that listed as number 0. I mean, that's part of the commandments. There's no instruction in it necessarily, other than know this. Believe this down into every fiber of your being, every cell in your body. Know that I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but show steadfast love to the thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male servants or your female servants or all your livestock or the sojourner who's within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heaven and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, his male servant, his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. And he begins by giving these laws, these instructions, these rules and statutes. And we see that these are laws that bring the sovereignty and the holiness of God, and it puts them into a framework so that we can think about God. God is a smoking, flaming something with trumpet sounds. What is God? Well, then he gives us laws. And these laws let us understand who in God what he is. Number one, he's special, and there's nothing else that's special like him. Don't you even pretend. Don't you even make anything that's going to be close to being God. Don't even use his name recklessly. That's what that being on the mountain is. See, the laws aren't just do this. The laws are what God is. They also reveal not only that, but our need to be holy because he is. We'll never measure up to that extent of holy, holy, holy. But these activities are going to get us to be more reverential and holy and special ourselves. And there's a whole lot of focus in these instructions on how we, not just how we regard the Lord above, but how we have regard for other people. There's a lot of dignity and care that is expressed by obeying these in our interaction with each other. And so first, God brought us out of Egypt. There is no other, and we're not supposed to make anything of our own because he is the jealous one who is above all. We can't have any regard for any other God. And I like how the Bible talks about that there are other gods. I mean, there aren't really any other gods. The Bible admits that, but it talks about the other gods because they're there. They're not real, but they're there. I mean, that's the way that even God says it. He says, don't bow down to those gods. He knows that's the way that we act. Whether they're real or not, sometimes we make them real. And so we cannot have regard for any other thing, and then we have to have the correct regard for God. We need to be reverential with his name, and if he gives us something special, like Saturday, we need to keep that in its right place. It's just Saturday. It's just being lazy on Saturday. It's not just Saturday. It's not just being lazy on Saturday. The way he keeps repeating the Sabbath and how he connects it to his labor for 6 days and the consecrated rest of that seventh day. The way the Hebrew author talks about the importance of that Sabbath rest. We were talking about it in the high school Bible class. There is something special about that day. And in our regard for that day in the Old Testament, we were meeting up with God because that's the way God was treating it. And he wants us to be like him. And then there are all these other commands that give us our relations with other people. You know, honor your father and your mother. That's about other people. It's about respecting someone else, not myself. It's not caring for myself. It's caring for them. But it's also, as Paul talks about, that's the first command that we got that has a promise hooked up to it. If you obey your mom and dad and jump out of the street, you won't get run over by a cement mixer and you will live long in the land. Well, there's a very practical response to that, as well as the spiritual connection. And then all the other commands from 6 through 10, right? The respect for life, the respect for others, the respect for other people's boundaries, the respect for other people's property, caring for other people and lifting them up beyond my own I want, I'm going to take. That's what these commands do. And the people passed the test. That doesn't mean that they obeyed these things. But the test shows up, we see, in verses 18 through 21. Now when all the people saw the thunder, which is just a funny line, they saw the thunder. They saw the thunder and the flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And people were afraid and trembled. And they stood far off and said to Moses, you speak to us and we'll listen. But do not let God speak to us lest we die. Moses said to the people, do not fear, for God has come to test you, that the fear of him may be before you, and that you may not sin. And the people stood far off while Moses drew near the thick darkness where God was. Do not fear. God came to test you to see that you would have the fear of God in you. These lines are just so interesting and so fun to think about. They pass the test. They're terrified. That's what we need to have out of that. And then we start getting these laws, and you can just start flipping through the pages, and you can look at your chapter headings and your section headings about all these different kinds of laws. And if you're thinking about the respect and reverence of God, or the respect and reverence of the duties, the worship things that he tells us to do, keep the Sabbath holy, you can see those kinds of laws. And then so many of them are about having respect and regard for other people. And as you start turning through the pages, you'll realize that that's where so many of these things go and what they're like. We learn what God loves. We learn what God is interested in. We learn how to be decent people, how to give restitution to people, and how to have justice, how to speak truthfully and behave truthfully, how to have the correct separations that we need in our world, how to be saintly, how to have sanctity and to be clean. And Ephesians chapter 5, verse 10, when it talks about, and try to discern what is pleasing to the Lord, guess what? You don't have to be very discerning. You just got to know the words of the Bible. And if you can't read them, there's apps that are going to read them out loud to you. And you can listen to what God says, and when you hear God say, thou shalt not, you go, oh, okay, that's a bad thing. And when God says, you need to, you go, oh, that's a good thing. And when you see Jesus doing something, you can know it's a good thing. And when you see the apostles doing something, and they don't get corrected, right? Sometimes they do things and they get corrected. But they do something and they don't have correction, you see it's as good for, oh, that's something I should do. And trying to discern what is pleasing to the Lord is found by looking at what God has said to us. And that's what we do. In chapter 24, then, we get this covenant with the Lord. It's brought out, and I do want to read verse 1 just to say this. Then he said to Moses, come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu. Not Nadab and Abihu, those are the bad guys. They're not the bad guys yet, right? I mean, this is adding that drama. We know what happens. And think about every Israelite who read through the story, just like all, we know they're bad. And like, look at what they get to be a part of in chapter 24. Look at what they are a part of in all of Exodus and Leviticus up until we find out that absolutely self-centered, knuckleheaded way they behaved. And when you look at all that stuff and start doing the math, you go, I don't think you should say, well, serves them right. I'm glad God did it. That should not be our attitude. But you might get a better picture on why God so easily and quickly gave them the judgment that they received. They are going up to have dinner with God here with the elders. I don't even know what it means, but they have dinner with God. Verse 9 of 24, then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone like the very heaven for clearness. And he did not lay his hands on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. I don't even know what that means. But there they are with God. And so God tells Moses to come up, and he's going to give them give more laws, and there's this more connection. And then starting in chapter 25, we get now commandments and law about the house of God. In chapter 25, verse 2, speak to the people of Israel that they take for me a contribution from every man whose heart moves him, you shall receive the contribution for me. From every man whose heart moves him. There are tithes and technical amounts and certain parts of livers and animals that are cut up that God says, this is what I want and this is not what I want. And in this one he says, what the people want to give, collect. God has a lot of varied ways that he interacts with us. Sometimes he gives us black and white rules, and then sometimes he says, you do what's right for you for me. You, in your heart, you think about this. That doesn't mean we get to make our own rules. He's given us a lot of rules. But sometimes he says, you need to use your own judgment here. Oh, how much? You're going to write a check for God. I mean, we contribute every week, but it's, you know, we're so used to we're contributing to the work here. It's not like writing a check for God. Oh, my goodness. What's the right amount when you're writing a check to God? That's an awkward question, right? But he wants us to think about that and think about that for ourselves. And right after he says that, he says, now you don't get to think about the way the Ark of the Covenant's going to look and the way the tabernacle's going to look. He gives us very specific rules. I want to read about one of the pieces here, the mercy seat, starting in chapter 25, verse 17. This is one of my favorite parts of all of Exodus. You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold. Don't call it the mercy seat. Leave it as a mercy seat. When we say the mercy seat, we start thinking of Indiana Jones and the box, right? And the lid. And the thing. God says, you're going to make a seat that God is going to sit on, and it's called the mercy seat. And sometimes I just forget that that's what it actually is. You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold. 2 cubits and a half will be its length, and 1.5 cubits its breadth. And you shall make 2 cherubim of gold, of hammered work you shall make them, on the 2 ends of the mercy seat. Make 1 cherub on the one end and 1 cherub on the other end. Of 1 piece with the mercy seat, you shall make the cherubim on its 2 ends. The cherubim shall spread out their wings above, overshadowing the mercy seat with their wings. Their faces one to another, toward the mercy seat shall the faces of the cherubim be. And you shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony that I shall give you. There I will meet with you from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim that are on the ark of the testimony. I will speak with you about all that I will give you in commandment for all the people. God sits on a seat of mercy founded on the box of his laws and testimony. What a cool image. And he shows up there and he tells us what he wants us to know. This is a very neat image. And you start turning the pages. There's a lot of pages to turn. You can turn all the way to 31. Just make it this way, make this that way, make this. And he's given us lots of detail about what he wants us to make. In chapter 31, we get Aholibab and Bezalel who are going to help him make it. And at the end of chapter 31, we have more about the Sabbath. He keeps bringing up the Sabbath and basically giving the same rules over and over again. And all I know to do with that is just reread it every time and try to figure out what is it about the Sabbath that is so important to God. I think it's curious. And the Lord said to Moses, chapter 31, verse 12, verse 13 now, you are to speak to the people of Israel and say, above all you shall keep my Sabbath, for this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I, the Lord, sanctify you. You shall keep the Sabbath because it is holy for you. Everyone who profanes it shall be put to death. Whoever does any work on it, that soul shall be cut off from among the peoples. 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall be put to death. Therefore the people of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, observing the Sabbath throughout their generations as a covenant forever. This is a sign forever between me and the people of Israel, that in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. And he gave to Moses, when he had finished speaking with him on Mount Sinai, the two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone, written with the finger of God. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. So Aaron said to them, take off the rings of gold that are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. So all the people took off the rings of gold that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron, and he received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with the graven tool and made a golden calf. And they said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord. And they rose up early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And the Lord said to Moses, go down, for your people whom you have brought up out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them. They have made for themselves a golden calf and have worshipped it to sacrifice to it and said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, it's a stiff-necked people. Now therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, that I may consume them, in order that I may make a great nation of you. And the chapter break, if you stop between 31 and 32, it's really good to recognize that while God is giving them these fabulous instructions about his house, what are they doing the whole time? What are they doing? They're being so selfish. Remember back in, I think I wrote Exodus 15, and that's totally wrong. I don't know where I got Exodus 15. Oh, 25 is what I meant to say. In 25:2, speak to the people of Israel that they may make a contribution from every man whose heart moves them. You shall receive the contribution from me. What did they end up? Now, Moses, he's been up on the mountain getting that verse. So they don't know that that's what God's asking them. But they're doing their own collection down there, aren't they? And remember how in chapter 20, the first commandment's not a commandment. The first commandment, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. It's not a commandment, and they still manage to break it. These are your gods who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Let alone the fact that they made the golden thing. I don't know what's worse. Making a golden statue and claiming that it's God, or just everything that, I mean, they were ready to worship it before it was made, right? They were gone before the thing was built. They were a mess. That image there in verse 1, when they saw that Moses was delayed, wow, that's all it took. You know, it's not we're starving, we're hungry, we're lonely, there's bad guys, there's a storm, Master the Tempest is raging, Moses isn't on time is their problem. And that's all it takes for us. Again, high school class is a lot on my mind. In Hebrews 2, verse 3, how shall you escape if you neglect? So great. All it is neglect. Oh my goodness, it's a little bit more delayed than I would like it to be. I might as well bow down to a hunk of metal. You know, like that's what we get ourselves wrapped up in. And that's what they do. Verse 6, that phrase, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play, is just as bad as you imagine it is. I mean, it's written to sound, I think it's a euphemism in the Old about whatever it was that they were going to do. And Old Testament idolatry and New Testament idolatry was always throwing money around and throwing, going after women and men. And there's all sorts of adultery and always wrapped up in that. Why is that the case? Because idolatry is self-worship. It's what do I want and what do I want right now? And I don't care about tomorrow. And that's the way that we used to be. We cannot be that way anymore. You do not bow down to your belly. You can't worship your gut and your feelings and your desires and your hungers. We got to be stronger than our hunger. And these people weren't. And so what is God like in 7 through 10? Leave me alone. I'm going to burn them up. I'm going to start over with you, which kind of goes against kind of the promises even that was made to the 12 tribes. Like, wait, what? And Moses intercedes. He says, Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians? Don't let anyone trash talk you because of what you've done in punishing these people. And he intercedes and he jumps in. God, you can't do this. This isn't right. Like, and a person on earth changes God's mind. That's what the story is telling us. And what does that reveal to us about God and who he is? In this chapter of all chapters, when a man changes God's mind about something, okay, I won't burn him up. Verse 14, the Lord relented from the disaster they had spoken of bringing on the people. This is who we worship. He shows up with fire and trumpets that we can't abide listening to. And when we stop listening to him, he is still able and willing to relent. And then in verse 15, Moses turned and went down from the mountain with the two tablets of testimony in his hand, tablets that were written on both sides, on the front and on the back were they written. These tablets were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. Can you imagine? We think it's cool to go to the Bible lands and to stand places where Bible people stood. Can you imagine touching a rock that God carved? Verse 17, when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, there's a noise of war in the camp. But he said, is not the sound of shouting for victory or the sound of cry of defeat, but the sound of singing that I hear. And as soon as he came down near the camp, he saw the calf and the dancing, and Moses' anger burned hot, and he threw the tablets out of his hands, and he broke them under the foot of the mountain. And he took the calf that they had made and burned it with fire and ground it to powder and scattered it on the water and made the people of Israel drink it. It almost sounds like Moses was surprised. He's like, God, don't burn them up. And then he goes and he looks at them, and he's burning them up. He's like, oh my goodness. It almost sounds like it was more than Moses could imagine. And Aaron talks about it in, I think it's in verse 22. You know the people. Absolute disregard. There are so many people that all they care about, and it's terrible when it's in the leadership, right? And Aaron's part of this leadership. It's terrible when people, they want peace, and they want comfort, and they don't want to deal with it. You know the people. So I just kind of made it as good as I could, and I sat back and watched, and joined in myself. And that's the way we act sometimes. You know how it is. I had no choice, said every selfish, self-absorbed fool in all of eternity. Jesus managed to never sin. And he makes them eat the bread that they wanted, right? Deuteronomy 8:3, man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. And he made them eat the bread that they cooked. He ground that thing up, spread it on the water, and said, eat it. Now in chapter 33, I'll try to speed up here. Look at verse 1. The Lord said to Moses, depart, go up from here, you and the people whom you have brought up out of the land of Egypt, to the land which I swore to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob, saying, to your offspring I will give it. I will send an angel before you. He had mentioned this angel before in this book, so this isn't a new idea. I will send an angel before you, and I will drive out the Canaanites and the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey. But I will not go up with you, lest I consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people. And when the people heard this disastrous word, they mourned, and no one put on his ornaments. For the Lord had said to Moses, say to the people of Israel, you are a stiff-necked people. If for a single moment I should go up among you, I would consume you. So now take off your ornaments, that I may know what to do with you. And therefore the people of Israel stripped themselves of their ornaments from Mount Horeb onward. And so what are they mourning? That they're being called names, stiff-necked? Are they mourning that they have to take off their jewelry? I hope they're mourning because God said, go, take the promised land, but I'm not walking with you. I'll send it. I've got an angel in front of you. He'll protect you. He'll drive out the bad guys. You got Moses. God says, I'm not going to go with you. If I stepped among you, I'd burn you up. This is a very curious moment to me. I don't know if I have all the answers for this. But this is, God says, I'm not going to go with you. The people are distraught. And jumping down in verse 12, Moses said to the Lord, see, you say to me, bring up this people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. You have said, I know you by name, and you have also found favor in my sight. Now therefore, if I have found favor in your sight, please show me now your ways, that I may know you in order to find favor in your sight. Consider, too, that this nation is your people. It's a really interesting set of things that Moses is saying here to God. God, you know, you're giving me this job, and I don't know what he means here. You have not shown who's going to go with me. I don't know if he's talking about which people and which not people, or this angel idea, or if he's somehow referring to God, because he's going to get to talk about God going with him. I don't know who's going to go with me, and you say that you know me, but Moses is like, I need more, and he's not being selfish here. What he's asking for is really interesting. Verse 13 again, if I have found favor in your sight, please show me now your ways that I may know you in order to find favor in your sight. And consider these people, that they're your people. Show me your ways so that I can know you and know how to make you happy, how to have favor in your sight and to receive your favor. Grace is a New Testament word connected there with that idea of favor. He's desperate to have God with them. Verse 14, and he said, my presence will go with you and I will give you rest. And he said to him, if your presence will not go with me, do not bring me up from here. For how shall it be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people? Is it not in your going with us, so that we are distinct, I and your people, from every other people in the face of this earth? God says, I'll go. He says, don't you send me unless you're going to go. What makes us different, God, is that you are with us, God. Show me your ways so that I can know you and have favor with you and be with me, because that's what makes me different. That's what makes all of us different. And all of a sudden, it sounds like Jesus saying, I'm going to go away. Where are you going? How do we follow you? I got to go away, Jesus says, but I'll send a helper. We are living in a time where God has continued to be with us and send his presence to be with us. Where two or more of us are gathered, Jesus is here with us. That's not magic church anywhere. That's God is with you everywhere you are. And that's what Moses is asking for. Verse 17, and this very thing that you have spoken, I will do. For you have found favor in my sight. I know you by name. Moses said, please show me your glory. And he said, I will make all my goodness pass before you and will proclaim before you my name, the Lord. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. But, he said, you cannot see my face, for man shall not see me and live. And the Lord said, behold, there is a place by me where you shall stand in the rock. And while my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen. And we're all interested in God's back. But verse 19, I will make all my goodness pass before you and will proclaim before you my name, the Lord, and I will be gracious and merciful. And that's the meat and potatoes. Moses is asking for something that we can have in no other way. How do I know how to be pleasing with God? You don't find it in your own heart and guts and thoughts. Because we're a mess, and we all have different ideas. We can barely agree on things like carpet color or naming a color the same name. So how on earth, with all the subjectivity of our own opinions on dumb things like color, could we ever come up with God on our own? We can only know God by how he has revealed himself to us. We can't know the truth, the great capital T truths, by looking at what we think about. We have to go out and examine it. I can't tell you the capital T truth about trees unless I go look at a tree and study a tree and examine the tree. The truth about trees aren't in me. It's out there. And it's how much more so with God. I cannot know the mind of God except the Spirit of God reveal it to me. That's 1 Corinthians 2. We won't know anything about God until God chooses to show us. And then, just like Moses does here in chapter 33, our desire to know it. Show me your ways so that I can know you and know how to please you, how to have favor in your sight. Oh, I got a bunch of verses that I haven't talked about here. I'm just going to keep moving on because I'm busy. I lost track on where I was in my PowerPoint. Who knows a person's thought except the spirit of that person which is in him? So also no one comprehends the thoughts of God except the Spirit of God. Now, we live in a day and age where you have your own special truth. Well, okay, you know, you have your own identity, and you can identify with a certain shade of green being green, but you know what? Everyone's going to disagree about what green is green and what blue is blue, and if you're colorblind, you're really messed up. And that's the way we are. And so there are little truths. We all have some little truths. But the truth is not in us. We can get it and put it in us. We can make it a part of our life. And we can live in that truth. And we can base our life on that truth. But we don't find it in ourselves. We find it out there. We find it in God. We find it in God's Word. And God reveals himself to man. And we see that there in verse 19. I will make all my goodness pass before you. So what are we more interested in? I wonder what God's back looks like. All right, we need to graduate past that question. I wonder what God is like. Look at 34 now. Chapter 34. He says to cut 2 new tablets of stone in verse 1. Be ready in the morning. Come on up, verse 2. Verse 3, no one can come with you. Verse 4, Moses cut them up. And then verse 5, the Lord descended in the cloud and stood with them there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and on the children's children to the third and fourth generation. And Moses quickly bowed his head toward the earth and worshipped. And he said, if now I have found favor in your sight, O Lord, please let the Lord go in the midst of us, for it is a stiff-necked people, and pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us for your inheritance. In verse 6, and it moves into 7, but 6 has some of these key words. Can you even read them? Yeah. When I looked up merciful, it said merciful and compassionate. When I looked up gracious, it said gracious. These words almost have no definition in the same sense that when we say in John, when we read in 1 John 4 that God is love and God is the definition of what love is, that's what these words are here. They are kind of roots. Like, this is what the base, all those other words, they're similar to grace, are coming back to this as this root. These words are almost exclusively used for God. And you can use them in other ways, and you can connect them to other things, but when you start looking at how all these words are used, these are God. These are Jehovah God words. The steadfast love is that Hesed word, which is translated all sorts of loving kindness, all sorts of different ways in all these different translations. And it's a complicated one about how to translate, about who and what God is. And so this is where we began. But when you read the story of what gets us to this statement, the Lord a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression for sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty. And that chapter 34 comes only 2 chapters after 32. And now we know what happens in 32 after everything before chapter 30. These verses all of a sudden have a lot more weight to me. And so then Moses asked, if I found favor in your sight, please go with us. And this is all we're asking God today. We come up to God and we say, dear God, please walk with me. And we have not come to the mountain of smoke and fire, like the Hebrew writer says. We're right there with God. We don't have to stop at the edge of the tabernacle wall or the edge of the tabernacle tent itself or even not even going. We can go all the way in now. But putting all that aside, even just the reality of we are begging God to go with us so that we can make it through. Because we don't do a good job some days. I think there's a lot of good people in here. I think we're doing a good job. Sometimes I need to remind myself that I fail. And I need God in my life. Psalm 86 and 103, we're going to read 86. Both borrow from Exodus 34:6. Exodus 34:6 should just be one of the passages that you memorize. And by that I mean remember Exodus 34:6 is important and then look it up every time, even if you can't remember why it's important. But this is where God is and lets us know who he is. And so these words, the merciful, gracious, long-suffering, steadfast love, truth, forgiving. They're gonna show up in the psalm, all of them I think once, and a couple of them more than once. We're gonna read Psalm 86, and then we'll be done with the lesson. Psalm 86. Bow down thine ear, O Lord, and answer me, for I am poor and needy. Preserve my soul, for I am. I can't even read my handwriting. For I'm in darkness. O Lord my God, save thy servant that trusts in thee. Be merciful unto me, O Lord. For unto thee do I cry all the day long. Rejoice the soul of thy servant. For unto thee, O Lord, do I lift up my soul. For thou, Lord, art good and ready to forgive and plenteous in mercy to all them that call upon thee. Give ear, O Lord, unto my prayer and hearken unto the voice of my supplications. In the day of my trouble I will call upon thee, for thou wilt answer me. There is none like unto thee among the gods, O Lord, neither are there any works like unto thy works. All nations whom thou hast made shall come and worship before thee, O Lord. They shall glorify thy name, for thou art great and doest wondrous things. Thou art God alone. Teach me thy way, O Lord. I will walk in thy truth. Unite my heart to fear thy name. I will praise thee, O Lord my God, with my whole heart, and I will glorify thy name forevermore. For great is thy mystery toward me, and thou hast delivered my soul from the lowest pit. O God, the proud are risen up against me, and the congregation of violent men have sought after my soul, and have not set thee before them. But thou, O Lord, art a God full of compassion and gracious, slow to anger and plenteous in mercy and truth. O turn unto me and have mercy upon me. Give thy strength unto thy servant and save the son of thy handmaid. Show me a token for good, that they which hate me may see it and be ashamed, because thou, Lord, hast helped me and comforted me. Show me a token for good. Which blessing are you going to point to? You have millions to point to. But God has given us his son. Token is a pretty mild word for that. But a good gift that we rely on and by which we have joy when we, by worldly standards, ought to be in tears. And by which we can survive when by worldly standards we'd be dead and gone. He sent us his son, and by his son we live and we will live. So let's remember who and what God is and what he's like. Let's keep him high in our hearts. If there's anyone here who needs prayers and help, I want to pray with you. I know that there's a lot of people here who want to pray with you. If there's anyone who needs help, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing.